معرفة.
My own background and experience that you have raised, you know that I come originally from Afghanistan. I was born in a village in an eastern province of Afghanistan in Nangarhar, not far from Jalalabad and also from Turkham, bordering on Pakistan. I'm bilingual by origin. I speak Pashto, which is my mother tongue, but I went to school in Dari, which is the Afghan version of Persian, and went to school in different places, in Jalalabad, then in Paktia. My father was a senior judge there, then in Kabul, in Habibi Alisi, which is quite well known. I completed my schooling. There was some government scheme that the Ministry of Planning and Justice operated. And through that, I got a scholarship to pursue my postgraduate studies in London, applied to be admitted to London School of Economics, and they did not recognize my degree, despite the fact that it was first class honors, top marks, everything. They did not recognize it. So I was asked to do a few papers attached to a professor. After about 6 or 7 months, I got a kind of approval, you know, pushing my case. Still in the new environment of, contacts in those days were not as intensive. Now Afghanistan is an open book in positive ways and also negative ways.
It is what we are experiencing, the global financial crisis. Is a crisis of capitalism. Liberal capitalism, crony capitalism, they have different versions. But over the years, I think the tail end of it, I also touched on the subprime mortgage crisis in the US. What happened that the property prices were rising over the years. Each time there was a marginal rise in the price of property, they refinanced. So much so that the same property is refinanced 3 or 4 times, layers after layers of financialization, to the extent that the property was under burden of debt. And they did the greed of making more money to the extent that they didn't look at the ability for repayment. They didn't bother about that. This the kind of the euphoria and exuberance that was that took over the market. The capitalists and bankers and fund managers, they were only too happy. Financialization overburdened the real economy, and this became the not just later and a development of kind of. It's been a consistent development over decades. By the time of the subprime crisis, from the writings that you might have seen, and I have seen, that the distance between the real economy and the financialization of the economy was grown 600 times. That the amount of debt that was generated was 600 times the amount of the real assets. And this is the kind of the question. the bubbles exploded, and the rest of it is, of course, history we have seen. But the strange part of it is that it is, we had one crisis in the 97-98, the next came 10 years later, and after that, now it's getting shorter and shorter, the gap between the crises. And the one that we are experiencing in Europe is again a crisis of debt. Now, earlier it was individuals, now it's the states and the system as a whole, to the extent that it is now putting the credibility of economies and of the whole system into serious questions. Now, whether the ripple effects of this, we say that Southeast Asian economies, they had the shock in 97-98, and they tried to improve the banking system, the financial system, the debt size was reduced and so on. Good work was done, but they are not in the dominant position. They still are at the receiving end of the tides of instability. But the worst part of it is that poverty is increasing. The general society, the storyline goes, it is privatization of profit instead of socialization of loss. And it is inherently unjust and unfair that the poor suffers, but on the side of the capitalists and the exploiters, the distance between the haves and the have-nots has been growing throughout 20th century, especially after the wars. At one time we used to hear that the lowest and the highest paid were 30 times the gap, but now it's more than 100, say 200 times the pay gap. It cannot stand to the kind of either logic or humanity or to the sense of fairness. And this is where we see that things are different in Islamic finance. Islamic finance cannot tolerate or proceed over debt. There are internal limits. For one thing, bay' al-dayn is actually prohibited. You cannot proceed over debts if debt dominates both sides of the bargain. Debt is acceptable if it proceeds over real assets and services, but only if it is on one side of the bargain, like Salam, like Bayr al-Saman Ajil, like the ordinary sale. Either the price can be delayed to a later date and it becomes a debt, or the subject matter, delivery of the subject. But you cannot postpone both in form of debt payable in future, because it would amount to gharar, uncertainty and risk-taking. And this is what exactly it is, the element that you find in capitalist economy. The risk-taking unlimited, debt generation unlimited. The poor is downtrodden, the capitalist is exploited. And this is the philosophy again of the prohibition of riba. Riba is exploitation. The poor is at a losing end. The capital owner is in a strong position, and you put the basic movers of deprivation and disparity right when you start by imposing
you borrow at a certain amount of interest. You don't know what happens in 3 years, 4 years' time. The person loses his job, or make big losses, or some climatic, agricultural calamities, or you know, life is unpredictable in terms of the kind of risk-taking that is involved in trading, in finance. And these are the lessons that we can learn from Islamic approach to finance, to banking, to the basic principle in these contracts that you have, like Musharaka, Mudaraba, Baby Saman Ajil, Murabaha, Salam, etc., is that they all proceed over the real economy, and that is not financialization, doesn't have much place. Money itself cannot be as a commodity. In a capitalist economy, this is another aspect. That money is, there is so much financial instability because money has become a commodity. And the interest rates change. And the unit of value is subject to so much instability, then the rest of it would be affected in the same way. This is the story of banking interest that has become exploitative. The base lending is 2%, the bank lending is 7%, 5% margin. The kind of leverage that you allow in the future trading and the other lines of trading is 1 to 40 times in this, what it is called, fractional reserve banking. The bank has $1, but it is allowed to generate money 40 times over. This is what we are up against, that it is not only rarar, but it is fraudulent. The customer's money is placed in hazardous trades without the customer's approval, without the customer's involvement, and the customer does not even benefit from it. And when the time comes for loss, it's the first time the customer. The other is that the bankers don't share loss. They only make profit. That is the nature of interest.
Right.
They don't share loss. Islamic banking proceeds over the idea of profit and loss share. Is the way to go about. One is the integrity of the concepts, also the rationale and the purpose.
Yes.
That is one thing. The other is some of the internal details, like microfinancing is one way that you can help the poor. Poverty is a real problem in the Muslim world. And some success stories that we had in Bangladesh, the Grameen Bank was a good example. The repayment rate was 95-98%. It's much better than the non-performing loans in the conventional system. And those people were enabled to set up a business or to if they were doing some farming, to buy some equipment and eventually to own. And this is, you can only go piecemeal. You cannot really make the whole country rich all at once. That is not, no one can do it. But there are ways of how you go about it. It
so far in the Islamic banking system, we don't have that. We don't. There are one or two cooperatives and Amane Ikhtiar in this country, and they are doing certain things. Good things, but only a marginal kind of, you know, only a small number of people can be serviced by. What we need to do is to make it mainstream. The Islamic banks to have microfinance in their profile is a requirement, significant. The other thing is that for giving of credit, whatever terms with you have, that you reduce these collaterals. There is so much demand for collaterals that you, the end story is that you only deal with the affluent. The persons who don't have collaterals, they are unable to borrow money to set up a business, to start something. You have the schemes that help the poor, like the zakat, for example. Zakat is not integrated into the banking system. They say we don't have to pay zakat. In Malaysia, only one or two institutions they pay zakat, but they should be. Why don't they pay it? I say to them, zakat is the government of Malaysia is tax deducted. So it makes good sense that you say to your customers, if you deal with us, you open account with us, we pay zakat at source here. You're welcome to do it. If you don't, then go somewhere else. This is what Tabung Haji does, maybe Bank Islam accounts also like that. And Muslims actually prefer to have that. There is a kind of appeal to that, but we have not integrated that into our system, not even in Islam. We should implement the zakat. And the writing is, if we were to be effective in the administration of zakat, it can go a long way. There are some articles and writings that the poverty eradication should be an engagement, not just of banking, but of governments.